And welcome to Against the Law, the ancient history podcast that aims to separate fact from fiction. In our elemental trio, this is the second selected subject and it is searing. So let me introduce the gang. Xenia's here to answer my burning questions about ancient Rome. Meg is here to stoke the fire of knowledge about the ancient Greeks. Fire away and ask Barney what he knows about the ancient Near East. And I'm Flo. I'm a bit of a damp squib when it comes to ancient knowledge. A dumpster fire, if you will. But I'm keen to learn with you, dear listener, all about ancient fire. So today's episode is a little spicy, but not in the way that TikTok has popularised. And Meg, I think you can tell us about where fire comes from originally in theory, in ancient Greek theory, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I would potentially replace theory with myth there, because they did have actual theories about fire as a classical element. But in myth, fire obviously comes from your man Prometheus, who nicks it from the gods and gifts it to us, very kind of him, which is such an iconic story. I feel like it comes up all the time. It's such a kind of, it's one of those Greek myths that's really entered the culture, you know, the zeitgeist, but the zeitgeist for like 2000 years, not the current one, both in terms of the actual stealing of the fire and also in terms of his punishment. So I can maybe just quickly run through the basic story. Or I don't know, Flo, do you want to tell me what you think happens?
So I think that Prometheus, so I'm going to make up a load of stuff to fill in the gaps of my knowledge. So is Prometheus like, Prometheus is either a god or a demigod or something, and he looks at the humans wandering around on Earth and is like, those guys look cold and really basic and like they're losers. Here you go, have some fire. And then the other gods find out and they're like, that...
You make him sound like Salt Bae. He's just sprinkling. But do you know what this needs?
It needs heating up. It does. So then I think the other gods get really mad and they go, do you know what, mate? That was whack. So I'm going to tie you to a rock and let vultures peck out your liver every single day forever for eternity.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
That's correct. Those are the headline facts, really. It's in different stories. So that's exactly the basic story. He's a god. He's a titan. So there's the Olympians, which are your standard Zeus, Hera, Athena, you know, the ones you know and love. And then before them, there were the Titans. And this is the whole thing about Zeus, like overthrowing his father and this kind of classic, slightly like Freudian situation. Anyway, so that's the situation. He's a Titan. So he's a slightly different type of god, which I think is probably important. He doesn't have a cult of worship in the same way that a lot of the other gods would have. So they would have temples dedicated to them. There would be like sort of cults around them and things called mysteries, which are basically like secret cults, but not cult in the sense that we would mean it. It's a sort of branch of a religion, of the religion in ancient Greece, and like initiation rites to get into those cults. Prometheus doesn't really have any of that. He's kind of big in Athens, but he's not really big anywhere else. Anyway, he steals the fire from Zeus. It's debated whether he steals it sort of for the first time to give it to humans. So as in humans have never had fire before, exactly as Flo describes, he sees them, he's like, oh, they look a bit chilly. Let's give them some fire. Or whether they had fire and Zeus took it away. And this is where it gets all a little bit sort of biblical, like it's almost like Zeus has punished the human race and Prometheus is like, no, no, I'm giving it back. So that's in different versions of the story, that's different. In some versions of the story, along with the fire, he also gives them basically kind of the arts of civilization is how it's often described, so like reasoning and agriculture and like maths, which honestly he could take back. I'm not a fan. And he kind of teaches us how to be like civilized humans, which is really interesting. So along with the fire, it's very much those sort of intellectual things as well. In some versions of the myth, he actually creates humanity. So that's like, it's kind of jumping up a level at that point. He like fashions man out of clay. And then the fire is very much like the cherry on the cake, the sort of spark of life. So like, I think that's such a huge range. Like either it's like Zeus has given humans fire and then just briefly takes it away again and Prometheus gives it back versus like he creates all of mankind.
I like how Zeus is like, actually, I preferred it when Earth had no people on it. And if when there were people, I wanted them to be cold, actually.
Yeah. In any version of the story, he comes across as a bit of a dick, doesn't he?
Yeah. And I wanted all of their burgers to be rare. No cooked food for you guys.
Do you know where else mankind is fashioned out of clay?
Is it the modern Prometheus, Barney?
Ooh, no. Prometheus, the ancient Frankenstein.
Exactly.
Barney, where else were people made of clay?
Mesopotamia. So yes, humankind is also believed to be made from clay in Sumerian mythology. It's our friend Enki, who I think we talked about recently.
Enki slash Ea?
Yeah, that's the same person. Different names, according to Sumerian or Akkadian. We talked about Enki last week with the water coming out of his arms.
So cool. Still not over that.
Dripping.
Yeah, dripping.
Dripping swag.
That's so fame.
Yes. So they use water from the Absu, which is the primordial waters at the start of creation. So there's clay again. Obviously, clay is very important to the people of Mesopotamia. So I think it's nice that that's part of mankind's essence as well for them.
It's also the clay link. So the reason I said is it the modern Prometheus earlier is that, and as you correctly worked out, Barney, is that is the subtitle to Frankenstein. So Frankenstein, as in the book by Mary Shelley, is subtitled The Modern Prometheus, because it's that idea of, so if you take the version of the Prometheus myth where he actually fashions humankind out of clay, then obviously that has a sort of an obvious relevance, but also the electricity that he uses, well, he doesn't do it out of clay, he gets the body parts, but then uses electricity to like zap the creature into life. In Frankenstein, the creature quotes Paradise Lost, which is obviously a biblical epic, and quotes Adam saying to God, "Did I request thee, maker, from my clay to mold me man? Did I solicit thee from darkness to promote me?" Which is such a cool, great line, I think. Straight fire, basically. But yeah, so the clay link is really important, that idea of kind of creating, and then the fire is important in all of those examples, is that like spark of life. So I just thought that was really nice that Prometheus, that myth is kind of reworked in Frankenstein in two different senses, both the like creating a person, but then also the fire as that spark.
That was absolutely brilliant.
That is really cool, Meg. Thank you for sharing. So do we have any other hot and spicy gods or goddesses in the ancient world?
Well, in ancient Rome, we've got the goddess Vesta, who's, and last time we talked about syncretizing deities, well, Vesta is the same as the Greek goddess Hestia, who's the goddess of the hearth. And given that she's the goddess of the hearth, where the fire is in the home, she has to have a fire burning at all times. And in fact, this fire came to symbolize the longevity, the perpetuity of the Roman state. So it was very, very important that this fire was kept alight at all times. And it was the responsibility of 6 Vestal virgins. So these are the women who, the priestesses of Vesta, who swear to be single, basically, until they're mature women, and basically until they're not fertile anymore. So they have their job to keep the fire burning at all times, except for a specific day of the year. So it was actually the 15th to 16th of June, which was when they would ritually extinguish the fire, sweep up all of the ashes, and tip them all into the Tiber.
Dang, the Tiber presumably at that point was quite muddy looking, I would have imagined.
Oh, it was horrendous, because like all of the sewage went in there as well, and like waste food, oh goodness knows what, like any kind of waste just went straight into the Tiber. It was an absolutely disgusting state. You did not want to swim in that.
That's really linking this episode with our last episode, just basically what's wrong with the Tiber.
Absolutely grim. Okay, well, that's pretty cool. I mean, it's not cool. Don't pollute your local waterways while you're trying to emulate. Praising the gods, I guess, is the moral of that story. So we've got Vesta / Hestia. We've got Prometheus. Have we got any other fire deities that we need to talk about and discuss today?
Well, actually, I was just thinking, based on what Xenia said about the sort of the hearth fire of Hestia and Vesta burning continuously in temples. This reminded me of the fire temples that they have in Zoroastrian religion, which is one of the indigenous religions of Persia. That was the...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was the religion of the Achaemenid Empire, so the empire of Cyrus and Darius the Great, and Xerxes, the great enemy of the Greeks, the one that eventually conquered the kingdoms of Mesopotamia.
Wasn't Freddie Mercury Zoroastrian, I think, Barney? Because his family was Parsi, and they had emigrated to Zanzibar, I think.
Oh, cool. Yes, yes. If Freddie Mercury has heritage in Iran, then yes, that would make sense. That's cool. Zoroastrianism does still exist today, but it's not in huge numbers. It was a religion in Iran for the Achaemenid period and also the Parthian and Sasanian periods that came afterwards. But it was broadly competed out by Islam once the Islamic conquests were underway. But yes, fire is very important to this religion, which was founded by a priest called Zoroaster around, well, I think it's not exactly sure when he lived, but around the sort of first millennium, start of the first millennium BC. And Zoroaster has another name, or another rendering of his name is Zarathustra, as in thus spake Zarathustra, which is the Nietzsche work that includes him as a character and also famous piece of music. Is it the...
I don't know. That was great, though.
Bum, bum, oh, is bum, that bum, bum, bum,
that's
bum,
the
bum,
thing
bum.
In Space Odyssey, isn't it? 2001
right.
Space Odyssey. Yeah,
oh, that's cool.
No. It's the thing that Kubrick copied from the Barbie movie.
Oh, yes, of course.
Anyway, good. Sorry. Back to fire. Yes, fire temples are a prominent feature of Zoroastrian religion. They are called Ataskada in the Persian language, I think. And these temples appeared during the Achaemenid period, where they contain an ever-burning fire as well, a bit like a hearth, which symbolized the sort of presence of the divine. So the fire itself wasn't worshipped necessarily, but it was a sort of representation of the divine presence of the sole god of Zoroastrianism, Ahura Mazda. Yeah, so that's fire. In the ancient Near East. But the history of fire there goes back a lot further. There are fire deities in Mesopotamia, as well as sun gods, I think, who I would probably say have some sort of relationship with fire, since, you know, the sun is, as we call it, a big ball of fire in the sky.
Did they know that?
Ah, no. No. Oh, God, I've got some great news for things that they thought that the sun was, if not a ball of fire.
I can't wait.
I'm going to need you to immediately spill.
Okay, great. This is probably not the order I was anticipating telling it, but I'm gonna go for it. Okay, what is the worst thing you think that the ancient Egyptians could have thought the sun was?
Spiders, eels,
farts.
Yeah.
Wool.
Not wool. It was okay. So it is definitely a natural world observation. Meg was close with spiders.
Oh, God.
What? Jesus.
No.
So the idea is, one of the ideas, excuse me, is that the sun is a giant ball of dung being pushed across the sky by a scarab beetle. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
That's yeah. Great.
The shiniest poo.
Literally insect related.
It is literally insect related. Yeah. So this deity is Khepri, who is the scarab
Khepri
god.
Khepri's son?
Oh my god.
What?
I've never thought of that before.
That's so funny. Khepri.
Yeah, Khepri. Which is rendered in English Khepri. So not far off. and yeah, the idea is that Khepri pushes the sun across the sky like a scarab pushes its ball of dung. Yeah. And so if you ever see little scarab amulets in the British Museum gift shop or in Egypt or something like that, they're all little representations of this solar deity.
So they say you can polish a turd, but that's the shiniest one I've ever seen.
Nice.
Very nice.
I love the idea that some, like, a primordial Egyptian was like looking at the ground and saw this ball of dung being rolled across and then looked up at the sky and was like, yep, that's similar.
I think you know, that's a pretty good explanation though, right? Because like so much of Egyptians' understanding of the natural world came from just observing things going on around them. And, you know, scarab beetles do push, or dung beetles do push, very nice round balls in a fairly smooth motion, I would say. So like, it's quite a good explanation. I think one of the other more famous explanations in ancient Egypt for what was going on up in the sun is that it was sailing on a boat, the boat of the sun god Ra, across the sky. Nice. And when it reached the horizon, then it sort of went into the underworld, and Ra travels through the realm of the dead, and that's nighttime, and then comes back in the east every morning with the sun on his boat again.
That's very similar to the Greeks. Helios is the Greek sun god. And I went to a sauna called Helios the other week near Dublin. And yeah, he drives his chariot across the sky from east to west and then goes down. Some accounts actually also agree with that, Bonnie, into the underworld, but some just say sort of underneath the earth and then comes back again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it's a chariot in the ancient Near East as well.
Sweet.
That's the sun god Shamash. That's his Akkadian name, or Utu, which is the Sumerian name. He has a charioteer as one of his main attendants. Interestingly, the sun god Shamash is supposed to be the son of the moon god, Sun, S-O-N.
That is interesting, that order.
Yeah, exactly, the hierarchy of moon above sun, which I think in our conception of the solar system obviously doesn't quite follow the same logic.
Yeah.
Yes, the temple of Shamash was called Ibaba, which means the shining house or the White House.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Nice. Rife for conspiracy there.
And yeah, it's Shamash who, because he sort of travels across the sky and oversees, you know, the world of humanity, he becomes the sort of the deity of like justice and law and truth, because he sort of knows everything and sees everything.
That's very cool. The Greeks call Helios like Hyperion, like Hyperion, which is still a word that gets thrown around, which means kind of the one above. So they also have that sense of like, just being really high up is quite important, like physically high up.
That's kind of like a thing that we see in all sorts of things, like in the Bible and stuff, right?
Yes, yeah. And, you know, the sky is very much the realm of the solar deities. And he, well, Shamash at least, he exits and enters the sky through the doors of heaven each day. So I think possibly a familiar image to us. There are, in fact, fire gods specifically in ancient Mesopotamia. There's one called Gira or Gibil, take your pick. If you prefer Akkadian or Sumerian there, I'm going to go with Gibil today.
I was going to say Gibil.
Gibil. And Gibil is like is deified fire itself and heat. So Gibil would be present in the heat of a summer's day or in the destructive force of a wildfire or in the kiln that bakes bricks and therefore founds cities. Quite nice that, whenever you come across fire, that's Gibil.
It's quite sweet. I shall remember to say thanks next time I light a scented candle to get rid of the smell of babies' nappies.
Thank you, Gibil.
Thanks, Gibil. Oh, you one, babe. Okay, so I've heard a lot about deity-related fire. Have we got any more human sort of fire?
I've got some humans being put on fire. Ooh. Very sadly. To distract blame from starting a fire. So I'm referring to the Great Fire of Rome, which happened in 64 AD. And this was when Nero was emperor. This is where the quite famous phrase, Nero fiddled while Rome burned, comes from. But against the law here, he probably did not start the fire, nor did he celebrate while the fire was happening. So Roman buildings went on fire like all the time because they didn't have very good building regulations, especially for poorer buildings or people like blocks of flats where poorer people lived. And often there would be like unattended fires, people cooking their food inside the flat or just trying to stay warm. By the way, I'm not being flippant here. Like they actually had blocks of flats. This is not a modernization being put on them. They like ancient Rome genuinely had blocks of flats. I kind of love that with the parallels to today. Sometimes I just think it's amazing. You kind of think that lots of things in the ancient world were different, including like high-rise buildings, but they won't have been as high-rise as now. But it's just so funny to think that the Romans had blocks of flats. Maybe that's just me, but I think it's great. However, it wasn't great for the Romans because, as I say, they kept catching fire, no building regulations, and they were often made of wood. So if a fire did happen, as it did in the summer of AD 64, and it was a particularly hot summer, and there was unfortunately a strong wind blowing as well, so this fire just took off. The historian Tacitus says it probably started in the shops around the Circus Maximus and then just spread through a lot of Rome. It was raging for 6 days in its kind of first iteration, and Nero was actually on holiday in Antium, but when he heard about the fire, in fact especially when the fire got close to some of his houses, he came back and he started organizing the rescue effort. So he was being a fairly good emperor in that context. He wasn't there. He didn't start the fire. He couldn't have done because he was on holiday. So, but then when he came back, he started trying to help the relief efforts. They did manage to stop the fire briefly, but then it actually restarted again a couple of days later. And by the time it was all done, 10 out of Rome's 14 districts, that's about two-thirds of Rome, was just in ashes. It was horrendous. It was the worst fire that Rome had ever witnessed. The trouble is, like, sentiment towards Nero was pretty negative at that point anyway. So even though he did try to help, he also didn't kind of help matters, or these rumours flying around that he helped to start the fire or he didn't care when the fire happened. He didn't help these rumours by just like commandeering a massive part of Rome and built himself a massive palace, which he called the Domus Aurea, the Golden House. Yeah, this is not good PR. So in order to kind of distract attention away from himself, he decided to blame the fire on Christians who were starting to become like quite popular as a sect in Rome at the time. And he burned Christians alive at a dinner party.
How horrible.
But OTT, you can just get candles like 5 for a quid at B&M.
Mm-hmm. Very dramatic. But Nero's nothing if not dramatic.
Did he play the fiddle, though, as Rome burned?
No. Violins hadn't been invented yet.
Right.
Against the law.
He was actually DJing.
Oh, so Nero, I'm sensing, probably not the nicest dude ever to exist.
Oh, he was awful. He was awful.
Bad sort.
Bad Nero. Don't like Nero.
Horrible History said he was the baddest emperor in their Baddest Emperor's song.
That's pretty persuasive evidence, yeah.
Yeah, I take that as fact, anything that they have to say.
But as you know, I'm not a fan of Domitian, and I think Nero gets a lot of attention. I think Nero was bad. I think Domitian was creepier.
Oh, okay. We might have to delve into Domitian.
Sorry, sidebar. Who is it with the little minnows that he had swimming around his feet, according to Suetonius? Is that Tiberius? The, like, creepy old man?
Yeah, that's Tiberius.
Mm.
He did a lot of things in water that he shouldn't have done.
Okay.
He should have had that last episode.
What not to do.
Xenia, there's not any sense that, like, fire is an appropriate punishment for Christians, is there? You know, like, it's almost sort of like a thematically relevant...
No, so this was very much within the context of the Great Fire of Rome. It wasn't anything to do with, like, interpretations of their beliefs.
Right, burn them as punishment for the fire.
Because there's a lot of, like, people being crucified on upside-down crosses or, like, X-shaped crosses. So there are senses of early punishments for early Christians being on a theme, and that could be seen as, yeah, mocking their beliefs in the crucifixion of Christ.
Okay, nice. Yeah, I was just thinking about purifying fire.
Yeah, strong theme in the biblical text.
Yeah, exactly, in the Bible, as well as sort of in ancient Near Eastern culture. Although really, like, I think fire and purification is quite a universal thing. I wouldn't want to overstretch there, but, like, it does seem to be a fairly common link.
How come, though? Like, what's the reasoning? Because I think that's quite hard in modern times to understand why fire is purifying. Like,
yeah.
It makes sense for water because you, like, get clean, you have a shower, you feel better afterwards. But why would fire be purifying?
I guess if it totally burns something up. Yeah, because that really is coded as destruction, isn't it, rather than purification.
But they did know about, like, heat. Like, if you think about treating, you know, they knew about boiling water and stuff, right? So it is literally purifying in some senses.
It's true.
It is cleansing.
Oh, I see. I always thought it was to do with, like, metal and purifying metal ores.
Uh-huh, interesting.
Yeah, that's another good point.
Did you know that in English, blank and black are etymologically related?
Hmm, didn't know that.
Ooh. So that, like, could be entirely, well, could almost be antonyms. Blank being related to, like, blanc in French,
mm-hmm.
Which is their word for white. They've both been borrowed from the same alleged Proto-Indo-European burning root, one that has ended up being, like, burning bright, and so, like, a white kind of fire, and then the other one has been being, like, a sort of, like, an ashen, sooty, burnt, like, combustion. that came to mean black. So you've got white and black with two, with both having their origins in fire.
Ooh.
That is so, so cool. Can I talk a little bit about the Greek word for fire, just on that note of etymologies and stuff? Does anyone know the Greek word for fire? Just a quick pop quiz. Because I feel like Latin, a lot of our words
Pyros.
Are fiery things. Yes. Well done, Flo. Yeah, smashed it. But yeah, pur. The genitive is pyros, which would be spelt pyros. That gives us like pyre, as in a funeral pyre. But also pyrotechnics. Obviously, techne is like craft or skill. And I don't know if anyone, I don't know if anyone's read The Secret History. I was thinking about this when I was researching for this episode, and I can't believe we haven't, I don't think we've discussed it on this podcast before, which seems like shocking to me because it was such a big part of how I kind of got into classics in quite an embarrassing way. But I'm just like shocked that I haven't managed to bring it up yet. And maybe I have, maybe someone's going to write in and be like, you mentioned it 6 times last week. But if everyone's okay, can I just read out like a quick bit of The Secret History, which talks about the word for fire?
Yes, as long as it's not your Henry fan fiction that you've accidentally mixed up there.
Oh, Barney, you've got me. I just wanted some constructive feedback. No, it's not. It is from the horse's mouth, from Donna Tartt's mouth. So Richard, who's the sort of protagonist, is thinking or talking, you know, thinking about learning languages and how different ideas feel different in different languages. And he says, certain common ideas become inexpressible, as in between languages. Other previously undreamt of ones spring to life, finding miraculous new articulation. By necessity, I suppose, it is difficult for me to explain in English exactly what I mean. I can only say that an incendium is in its nature entirely different from the feu with which a Frenchman lights his cigarette, and both are very different from the stark, inhuman pur that the Greeks knew, the pur that roared from the towers of Ilion or leapt and screamed on that desolate, windy beach from the funeral pyre of Patroclus. Pur, that one word contains for me the bright, terrible clarity of ancient Greek. How can I make you see it, this strange, harsh light which pervades Homer's landscapes and illumines the dialogues of Plato? Isn't that good?
Oh, it is rather.
Ooh.
So good.
I like that. I like all the language stuff in The Secret History about like how learning a language, it does, you know, you can think slightly differently with new words.
I like how, what that really drew out for me at least, was just how like raw and violent fire could be in ancient imagination. Like today, I think when we think about fire, it's maybe a fun bonfire or a fire in a grate. It feels like we've gone to these quite extreme lengths to very much control fire, whereas that sort of idea from The Secret History is that it was uncontrollable, it was raging, it was all consuming. And I think, yeah, I think it's important to kind of draw out that fear of fire that was very real because they didn't have ways to control it so much. Except yeah. for the Roman firefighters.
Yeah.
That is so good.
I didn't even know what that I was going to go there when I started. Really? But I was like, oh, here we go. We've ended up here.
Amazing.
So yeah, the Romans tried. They tried very hard. They didn't try hard enough in the Great Fire of Rome, clearly, but they did have these fire brigades. So their public firefighting service was called vigiles, is how they would pronounce it in Latin. But we would say that's where we get the word vigil from, because it starts with a V. But they said a soft V, so it's vigiles. And they were set up initially as like these private troops. And in fact, a guy called Crassus, we've mentioned him a few times, he was very, very wealthy. He was in the late Republic. He had his own private firefighting force. What he'd do is if a building, a wealthy person's house or even a block of flats, if that caught fire, he would send his private firefighting force there. He would buy it off the owner for a quick deal. And then his firemen would put out the flames and he would have a new house and he'd do it up afterwards and then sell it on. So for him, it was like a money-making scheme. These firefighters helped him with his money-making scheme. But later, under Augustus, Augustus set up a public firefighting force. And they had this really, really cute uniform They had this little like cloak poncho thing, like a really short cloak that just went over their shoulders and had a little hood. And they had a short sword because they kind of doubled as like night watchmen. So they would break up fights and be a kind of a bit of a public security service as well. And they carried little buckets and brooms. So their nicknames, even though their official names were Wigiles, they were called Spartioli. And that came from Spartius, which means made of rope or broom.
Ooh.
That is so cute. Has anyone ever got the train to Oxford from Marylebone, not from Paddington?
Oh, that is a nice service.
And have you seen the staff on those railways? Because they are dressed exactly like that. And they
really?
Often have they've got a cute little cape. They don't have the swords. But as soon as you start describing it, I was like, Chiltern Railway have stolen these guys. And they're red. They're bright red. So that made me think of it as well.
Aww.
I was really hoping, Xenia, that you were going to say that they used the swords to fight the fire. like you said, like, you can't, you know, you've got to fight fire with fire. But Rome was like, no, we shall fight it with swords.
There are quite a lot of jokes in like ancient comedies about the local firefighters seeing smoke coming out of a kitchen where someone was having a dinner, thinking it was a fire, and just like rushing in and crashing the party and chucking buckets of water at people.
That's so great. I love the jokes from the ancient world where you're like, yeah, it's actually quite funny. Like, I can imagine that being really funny. Like, it's like a classic Roman stand-up bit, the fire brigade.
Oh, the Romans loved a good bit of slapstick comedy. I can't really forgive them for that, to be honest.
So, presumably after being gifted fire by the deities, how would humans have used fire? What is a practical use for fire for ancient humans?
I think I have a good answer to that. Beyond the obvious uses of fire in, you know, cooking and baking bricks and, you know, blacksmithing and other sort of professional uses, fire also had an important role to play in Mesopotamian rituals, especially one called Sherpu, the Sherpu ritual, where fire is used to sort of remove sins from somebody as a sort of, it's the same idea that we alluded to earlier of purifying fire. So the Sherpu ritual is one that you seek out when you're having some bad luck, but you don't know why. You don't know what you've done to wrong your personal god. And so if you don't know the source of the ill will that's being pointed at you, or you don't know what the infringement is that you've done, you use the Sherpu ritual. So a magician or physician will come and help you as the patient, and what they do is they enumerate all the possible sins that you could have committed, and the client then burns something in the fire as a sort of a analogy for undoing the sins. But the things that they burn, I think, are quite interesting because they just seem quite mundane. So one of the things that you might do to absolve yourself of these sins is peel an onion into the fire or unravel a mat.
Onion, burned onion.
I know, sounds very delish. Nice. I think it's hot dog sellers, you know, caramelized onions. wafting down high streets after nightclubs are kicking out. Yeah.
Those guys on the South Bank with their nuts, they always smell so good.
They're just burning away people's sins. But fire, you know, fire crops up quite a lot in Mesopotamian rituals, but also in incantations. You know, I think predictably, as it is in English today, fire is quite like a poetic concept. And one nice use of fire is as a sort of a metaphor for fever spreading through people's bodies. So, you know, we talk about stuff spreading like a wildfire today, for example. And so I found a nice incantation against fire that talks about fire seizing people's insides and so spreading through the body, but also spreading through the population and generally like infecting others very much as a wildfire spreads. So I thought that was quite nice. That felt quite modern to me.
Totally. The Greek word for fire, pur, can also mean fever as well. Like, and I guess we would say the same, like, you know, she's burning up or whatever. We use that exact same metaphor. That's great. That's really cool.
That is cool, Barney. Thank you. Any other uses of fire in the ancient world?
So this is kind of an obvious one, but obviously just like fires for warmth and vision, like for a light source, are quite important. So there's a bit in the Iliad. I've been really good and not brought up Homer for a little while. So here we go. In the Iliad, there's obviously, it's the sort of setting of most of the fighting is this Trojan plain. So the kind of plain out in front of Troy between the citadel and the sea. And there's one bit in book 8 where the Trojans are doing really well. They're kind of advancing on the Greeks, and they think they're going to win. They're really confident that they're going to, you know, defeat the Greeks, send them away. And they're so confident that they actually think the Greeks might run away in the night. So they sort of camp out, some of the Trojans camp out on the plain in front of the city, in front between the city and the Greek ships. And they light a load of campfires, you know, just so that they can camp, but also so that they're sort of like, they're showing their presence and that they'll see if the Greeks try and run away. And this is often, there's a simile, an epic simile at this moment that's often described as one of the nicest ones in the Iliad. So I might just read that out. I know I've read a lot of poetry today, I've read a lot of literature today, but I do think it's quite nice. So he says, "Just like those times when the stars shine bright in heaven, clustered around the glowing moon with no wind at all, and every peak and jutting headland, every forest glade is clearly visible, when every star shines out and the shepherd's heart rejoices, that's the way the many Trojan fires looked as they burned there in front of Ilion, between the river Xanthus and the ships, 1,000 fires burning on the plain."
Beautiful.
One of Big H's finest.
I wonder if we should end on that beautiful note and have a think about our favourite hot things from today. Meg, since that was rather beautiful and it came from you, I think I'm going to start with you first. What was your favourite thing from today?
I think my favourite thing was Xenia's description of the Great Fire of Rome. Obviously, I'm familiar with that, but it's just such a horrible story. And then the way that leads into the burning of the Christians, but also just the fire itself. I think it must have been so horrific, and it's such a terrifying story. But I think Xenia told it really well. So it's an odd favourite thing. It's like when people say on Twitter, like, I'm not liking this, but that was, I thought, very interesting.
It was very interesting. And Xenia, since that was your little fact, I'm coming over to you.
I liked learning about Zoroastrianism from Barney. That was really fascinating. And to hear the kind of channeling of that word, like Zoroastrian, Zarathustra, and all of these kind of references in music and film and literature today, I think that's really cool.
It was really cool. Barney, what was your favourite thing?
My favourite thing today was also a Xenia thing. I really enjoyed the description of the uniforms of the, was it Spartioli?
Yeah, the Spartioli.
Yeah, the Spartioli and their great uniforms, because who doesn't love a Roman in uniform?
Oh, dang, you went there.
Roman.
I think my favorite thing was Meg telling me that I was good for guessing that pyro meant fire, because that gave me an inflated sense of ego, which I really need these days, you know? So that was my favorite thing. Thank you, Meg. And thanks for a very hot and heated episode of Against the Law. If you've enjoyed today's episode, you can always choose to support us on Patreon.
We've got all sorts of tiers for every budget, starting from just £3 a month. Benefits include getting each episode a day early, stickers, and your name in cuneiform.
You can find us on Twitter at Against Law, and you can also find us on TikTok at Against the Law Podcast.
We're also always happy to hear suggestions, questions about the podcast, and other requests. If you want to email us, our email is againstthelawpodcast@gmail.com.